Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, state security in crisis, President Ramaphosa turns to yet another inquiry. South Africa to launch a digital travel system in September. Why a third of South African workers quit bad bosses, and why some countries flourish and others don't. It's Monday, the 14th of July. And this is our lead story today. It's being called one of the biggest crises of President Ramaphosa's presidency. Explosive allegations by KZN Police Commissioner Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi have blown the lid off what appears to be a deeply embedded web of corruption and collusion within South Africa's law enforcement agencies, with links to drug cartels, political assassinations, and senior police generals. In response, the president has announced a judicial commission of inquiry.
As we intensify the fight against crime, it is vital that we safeguard the integrity and credibility of the police and other law enforcement agencies. These allegations, therefore, call for an urgent and comprehensive investigation. To address these allegations and the implications of these allegations, I'm establishing a judicial commission of inquiry that will be chaired by Acting Deputy Chief Justice Mbuyisile Madlanga. Justice Madlanga will be assisted by Advocate Sesi Baloyi, Senior Counsel, and Advocate Sandile Khumalo, Senior Counsel.
But critics say this is too little too late. The political temperature is rising just as the Government of National Unity continues its fragile journey. I want to get a view now from political commentator Professor Darkotsa from UNISA. Professor, a very warm welcome. And in your opinion, is this the most serious institutional crisis that President Ramaphosa has faced since taking office?
Yes, I would say so. I think from an internal point of view, obviously the COVID-19 pandemic was a huge challenge for him and for the government in general. But this in terms of government itself and the internal workings of government and the related institutions, state institutions like the police, it certainly is, I would say, the most serious and the situation with the most possible serious implications ultimately.
Well, let's talk in just a moment about the impact as far as credibility on the Government of National Unity is concerned. But as we know, overnight, moving to announce a commission, but only after days of intense media pressure. I'm wondering if this suggests a reactive rather than a decisive head of state.
Well, in this case, I think President Ramaphosa was under tremendous pressure, as you said. And it was not only from within the Government of National Unity and with parties like the DA specifically, but it was much more public in nature. The fact that there's even now some public announcements of marches in favor of General Mkhwanazi means that it's something completely different than what President Ramaphosa had to deal with in the past. So it is, I think, to a large extent, something that is a result of pressure and not necessarily that it is a proactive measure from his side.
Professor, there are questions being asked about why he fired the Deputy Trade Minister, part of the Democratic Alliance, yet only suspended the Police Minister. What do you read into that?
Well, I think in the case of the Deputy Minister, it was much more of a political decision. And it was because the evidence that we have now available is that we were internally criticized quite a number of the policy matters within the department and the Ministry of Trade and Industry and Competition. So it was in essence a political decision. This one is more far-reaching because it has serious political implications, but it has also legal implications, and the fact that it affects such a wide range of persons, because it's not only the minister, it also affects the top structure of the police services, and maybe even some others that we are not aware of yet. It is almost what I would call a state capture in the making that we are seeing here. And therefore, I regard it personally also as a very important issue.
Well, given Mkhwanazi's claims of political interference and cover-ups, as I alluded to a little earlier, it will raise the question, surely, about whether the public can still have confidence in the SAPS and crime intelligence structure, surely.
Yes, for sure. And I think this is not just because of these latest developments. Over many years now, credibility of the police service have been declining. I mean, one can go back to Jackie Selebe and others. One can go back to the role of the previous minister, Bheki Cele, and the way in which he managed his portfolio, as well as the fact that there's some general perception that the police is simply either not prepared for what they must do or ineffective and maybe even infiltrated by criminal factors also. So this is, in a sense, a confirmation of something that I think many people, many of the public, actually believe about the police service for long already.
Professor, you talk about this moment mirroring elements of the state capture era. So I'm just wondering if the judiciary is the right place to park this issue, or do you think it's just a way of delaying real political accountability?
I think that the challenge for President Ramaphosa is he is, as we know, very cautious in all the actions he takes. And that is that in his mind, he needs to have evidence in order to take wide-ranging decisions. So I think that is his way. At the same time, it, in a sense, in inverted commas, it depoliticizes the process. And I think from a longer-term perspective, it might be a good thing, although in terms of the immediate needs, I don't think this mechanism is going to produce the results that I would say the public in general would like to see, and that is that there's speedily results, and there is results which are not necessarily based on thorough investigations and interrogations and all of that, but simply because the president does have the authority to fire and to hire purely on in terms of his own preferences. He does not have to give reasons. He does not have to have evidence against someone, and I think this is where people are saying is overcautious, in specifically in this situation again.
Well, let me pick you up on that word, cautious, then. Some observers are suggesting that the president has, in fact, become a hostage to the whole nature of compromise within politics. Do you think that is true?
Well, he is a person who works with compromises, and we all know yes. This history is that of a negotiator first in the trade union movement and later the constitutional negotiations. And that's the very nature of negotiations, is about consultations, compromises, and trying to find a middle position. I think he has taken that into his own businesses, apparently, but he has taken it into the presidency also. And that creates, I think, the frustration for many, because compare him with other very assertive presidents. President Trump is possibly the extreme example of that. But what is possible? But I think he is just very sort of sensitive for the idea that he doesn't want to make mistakes, because he is on a slippery slope. Given what happened to the previous ANC presidents, none of them are very much assured of their positions.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Professor Derkotse from UNISA. Thank you indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa is set for a transformative shift in its immigration policy. Starting in September, the country is going to adopt something called a fully digital AI-powered electronic travel authorization system. It's supported by two new visa categories, the Stages Scheme for film productions and the Meets Scheme for business events and tourism. As far as I understand it, these reforms are part of a broader effort to dismantle red tape and boost the economy. The Federated Hospitality Association, represented by its national chair Rosemary Anderson, says the changes could revive the struggling sectors within that space and obviously create jobs and maybe help showcase South Africa to the world. She joins me on the program now. So, Rosemary, this launch in September, AI-powered, mobile-ready, how important is it and what are you hoping the benefits will be?
Oh, Jeremy, it's vitally important. In fact, it's exactly the opposite of what we've had for a number of years now, where unfortunately the Department of Home Affairs has been one of our biggest burdens in attracting tourism to South Africa. You'll recollect the introduction of the unabridged birth certificates and then how difficult it was for people to get visas. So there's a totally new way of looking at things now where they're actually looking at how Home Affairs can actually translate into an economic enabler for South Africa. So what he's basically, the minister's doing and his team are doing, is they're trying to streamline things to make it a lot easier for people to come into South Africa. So they've got something called the ETA, which is the Electronic Travel Authorization, which is going to be totally digital, and which will mean that within seconds through AI, people be able to receive their visas coming into South Africa. And what he's doing in the meantime, while this is waiting to be rolled out at the end of September, he has introduced two other things. They're like interim measures, basically, before we wait for the ETA. And one of them is the stages, which is the Screen Talent and Global Entertainment Scheme. And this is to fast track any company that's going to do filming or any form of production into South Africa. They'll be able to apply through a dedicated online portal and they'll be able to receive decisions within hours. So they'll be no longer having to require to visit in-person missions, etc. And then the second one is MEETS, which is Meetings, Events, Exhibitions and Tourism Scheme. And through this, attendees will be able to also get their visas in rapid turnaround times.
So this is good news. And you talk about both of these sectors being economic enablers. But what concrete gains then do you see for film and the my sectors in the short term? Or is it going to take a while for the potential to be realized?
Oh, no, I think it'll be immediate. We've just got to get that information out there that we are open for business because we've been literally turning business away. Conferences, a lot of delegates coming here haven't been able to receive their visas, particularly delegates from China and India. And we just make it difficult for them to come to conferences here. So the my sector are definitely going to get this very good news out there, knowing that there are no impediments now to hold a conference in South Africa. We are open for business. And exactly the same thing for the movie production companies. Minister Schreiber made reference to an incident where Netflix production was going to be made here, but then it was turned away, it went elsewhere because we actually just couldn't get the visas in time. We've been losing money. We've been losing so much business. And this is now gone. So now we are going to capitalize on this and get the news out there that we are open for business.
I understand your optimistic tone, Rosemary, but haven't we lost that ground already over the long or the short to medium term, given that conferences and film production is all about long-term planning anyway, and many of these projects have gone elsewhere?
You're perfectly right. We've lost them. All of those, we can't get them back. However, we can only look at the way forward. And as long as we get that information out there as quickly as possible, we should be able to start seeing the returns within the next year. Remember, some conferences have got a lead time of a year, so we should be able to get those in. And we are still hosting conferences. It's not like we aren't hosting them. It's just with difficulty. So I hope I'm not too optimistic, Jeremy, but look, we've got to look forward. We can't change what was in the past, but it is just so refreshing to have a minister who actually sees his department as an enabler for job creation and economic growth in our country. And as Fithausa, we've been going on about this for years. So maybe that's why I'm so optimistic, because for so many years we've been going on, please do this, please do this, and he's doing it. So we are really thrilled.
Rosemary, I'm not criticizing your optimism at all, but that's a good thing. But important that you and your members also hold the system accountable as it starts to scale. How are you going to do that?
Very much so. And we're looking forward to him engaging with our industry, especially with regards to some of the, for example, visitors from UK, America who don't have visas. How's that going to work with the new ETA? So all of this, there's lots of engagement. But we do know that his department's aim is the same as ours. So we're aligned in that regard. And that's why we're feeling really positive.
It's important that that operational hurdles, though, are overcome. I'm thinking of capacity, I'm thinking of technology and fraud prevention, all well and good for these fast-track platforms to promise visa decisions in hours, but cognizance needs to be paid to potential wrinkles in the system, surely.
Oh, sure. I'm sure there will be some teething problems, but the important thing is that we're doing it. I know that he's involving SARS a lot. They've actually helped with quite a lot of the systems that he's already implemented. You know, he's also done the TTOS, the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme, and that's gone really well. So we could only be positive that what he's done so far has worked. I think it's brought an additional 17,000 Chinese and Indian tourists to our country since February this year. So we can just be positive. I'm sure there will be problems, but the important thing is that he does it and he's not just talking about it. Because for so many years, we spoke about having a digital visa system, but it really never was. It was just an online system, which with lots and lots of humans behind the back of it. So we are positive.
Beyond visas, and you talk about broader digital transformation, that's absolutely critical. And we've also got to fast track things like smart ID services in banks, which also have an impact on hospitality long term. So this is a good start, but much work still needs to be done in order to make this even more tourism friendly, surely.
Very much so. And also for us as citizens of the country, I know that the ministry is going to be using banks as a big outlet to actually make IDs and passports and all of that more accessible to us. You'll be able to get your ID or passport from the bank, or you'll be able to have it delivered. So I think he's just looking at it from A to Z. And he's not only looking at it from a point of view of encouraging and being an economic enabler, but also to stop the fraud that is happening, which unfortunately has really damaged tourism too. And that's why a lot of us are not as well accepted overseas as we used to be. As we all know that we were able to go to the UK before without the whole system like there is now. And a lot of it, we were warned about it and we didn't do anything about it. So I think from A to Z, there's positive in what he's doing.
Rosemary Anderson is the National Chair of the Federated Hospitality Association of South Africa. Thank you very much.
Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA. Mind-blowing, innovative and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other. A unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy six unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff. Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, when we talk about progress in Africa, we often default to economic indicators like GDP or job creation. But what if we looked beyond income and measured how people are really doing? Something called flourishing. It's not just surviving. There's a groundbreaking new study led by African scientists and offers a broader, more human-centered way, I think, of describing it, of measuring well-being across the continent. And in that respect, I want to talk to one of the authors of the study, Dr. Victor Counted, Associate Professor of Psychology at Regent University and co-developer of Africa's Flourishing Index. So, Victor, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with the big idea, if we can. What exactly does it mean for a country or its people to be flourishing? It's an interesting word.
Thank you. When we talk about flourishing, essentially, it's essentially about thinking about what a good life might be, but in relation to one's environment, you know, a state in which all aspects of one's life is good, but in relation to one's environment. And I think with flourishing, it's sort of a comprehensive way to sort of measure well-being that reflects how good a person's life is across different dimensions. And when I say dimensions, we're looking at things like life satisfaction and happiness. We're looking at things like mental and physical health, meaning and purpose, character and virtue, social relationships, and material and financial stability. And particularly, I think character and virtues, it's very important. And it's one of those dimensions that it's often not captured when we think about well-being. And I think with the Global Flourishing Study, what we've been able to do is to kind of think about character and virtue as an essential aspect of what it means to live a flourishing life, essentially, which kind of complements with what flourishing might look like in many environments that might not particularly have a semblance of, you know, Western sensibilities in it.
And your argument, if I read this correctly, is that traditional metrics like GDP and life expectancy are only telling part of the story. But you're not discounting them, though, are you?
Not really. I think, you know, with our current index or measure itself, I think it could be complementary, because at the end of the day, I think thinking about GDP per capita might be valuable to some degree, but not always. But when it comes to measuring what development is in Africa, when it comes to measuring whether or not Africans are flourishing, I think it's important to look beyond just the GDP, which just tells us about economic outputs, right? It says the GDP tells us nothing about whether people are actually living meaningful, dignified life. Maybe GDP per capita might be very low, but people, in spite of the challenges that they face, still hold up their head high and still, you know, continue to live in character and virtue. And I think that's very important to kind of, you know, mark those as markers of development and flourishing. And so you find in many African countries things like resilience, joy, you know, sometimes strong moral character, hope, you know, are quite high despite GDP. And actually, that's one of the things that we found with the Global Flourishing Study, where we found in some developing contexts, in some non-Western contexts, that actually, you know, they were doing well when it came to things like meaning and purpose, when it came to things like character and virtue, right? You know, maybe financial stability might not be the best in those contexts, but essentially, you know, in other dimensions of life, they are doing well. And I think that tells us something, right, about what a flourishing life is, that it's not just one thing. It's not just about material well-being, which is often what we focus on, right? When we think about what development is. For example, Nigeria actually ranked about fifth globally in the non-financial flourishing. When we consider when we remove the financial indicators, it was even ahead than most wealthier Western countries. And that tells us something, that when we minus the economic value of development, that Africa, to some degree, some African countries might be doing okay, you know, in some sense. And so we need those kind of metrics, essentially.
South Africa placing relatively low on the scale, are you able to discern what key factors are holding this country back?
That's a good question. You know, this is one of the questions that myself and some of my colleagues, we kind of actually asked this question. I have one of my friend, Richard Calden, who was actually originally from KwaZulu-Natal. He's one of the colleagues on the team. And we were trying to think about, for South Africa, that what might be happening within the South African context. I think, you know, one thing is clear, really, we can't remove the South African history as well. There's something about relationships in South Africa, the close relationship dimension, that might somehow be, you know, puncturing the possibility of what a flourishing life might look like for people in that context. I say this because one of the papers that I'm leading in the Global Flourishing Study is on belonging. So I'm looking at belonging across all the 22 countries in the Global Flourishing Study. And something I noticed that kind of stood out was the fact that within this variable, essentially with South Africa, things like You would expect, for example, people that attend religious services when they were little. So we're looking at childhood predictors of belonging. We found that people that attended religious services when they were little, that led to having a better sense, a stronger sense of belonging as adults. But in South Africa, for some reason, that wasn't the case compared to most countries. That even though you would expect that people go into some kind of religious community, being part of a religious community as children, that when they're adults, that would lead to some kind of belonging. But that wasn't the case. And that goes to show maybe there is something, either trauma associated with certain history, being part of a community, or something that we don't understand. But I think this is what is clear, really. The need for South African social scientists and psychologists to actually think about what does this result mean for us? And how can we understand the unique emic sensibilities that might be shaping, that might have caused this or might be shaping what or what it's not a flourishing life in our context, you know? And when we think about those metrics that are context-sensitive metrics for South Africa, perhaps we can better understand what might be, you know, happening, you know?
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. That's Dr. Victor Counted, Associate Professor of Psychology at Regent University, also co-developer of Africa's Flourishing Index. Victor, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, here's an interesting question. Is your boss brilliant or just dangerous? A new wave of research is exposing the darker side of leadership in South Africa's workplaces, showing how narcissistic and psychopathic traits are not just tolerated in boardrooms, but are often rewarded. These so-called dark leaders may be charismatic, they may be bold, but behind the charm is a trail of emotional damage, burnout, and resignation. National data shows that a third of South African employees quit because of toxic leadership and the ripple effects on productivity, I guess morale and mental health, and they will be massive. I want to talk about this in a little more detail now with Professor Renata Skuman, Head of Healthcare Leadership at Stellenbosch Business School. And let's talk about how toxic leadership is quietly eroding our workforce, and more importantly, what exactly can be done to stop it. So, Professor, a very warm welcome, and maybe explain to me, what exactly is dark leadership and how common is it in companies these days?
Thank you, Jeremy. Yeah, when we use the term dark leadership, it is a form of toxic leadership, but it's specifically referring to a leadership style where there's behaviors that are harmful to individuals and the organizations. It is linked with an increase in stress and anxiety, as you mentioned, depression, reduced job satisfaction, and high employee turnover rates. I think what is important that we often use the terms narcissism and psychopath very loosely. And this is not what we mean here. We're not just referring to challenging people. We are referring to people with clinically identifiable traits that's used to the detriment of others.
Are you able to tell me then what the difference is between a tough boss and a dangerous boss? Is there a clinical line here?
Yeah, definitely. As I mentioned, the tough boss still have the best interest of the organization at heart and might defy standards and might not have the most emotional EQ or social EQ and come across abrasive of anything like that. But when we talk about narcissism and psychopathy, as I mentioned, we look at certain traits such as grandiosity, entitlement, the constant need for admiration, but specifically the lack of empathy and the arrogance and the superficial charm and manipulative behaviors and a total lack of remorse. And they often use toxic strategies such as withholding information or even direct manipulation and bullying. And it's all about themselves and their own agenda. And they do not care about the consequences and the emotional impact on others or eventually eroding the bottom line of the organization.
So are there specific early warning signs that employees or even boards for that matter should be watching out for?
Yeah, I think if we talk about on employment level, when we especially hire for high positions, it's a good idea to look at psychometric assessments where we can often pick some of this up. How it plays out in an organization more often is that people that's on the receiving end feel almost puzzled by the reaction they just witnessed, whether it's aggressive outburst or whatever. But we also see specifically with narcissism that people are isolated, the communication are distorted, so crucial information might be withheld, and you're in a meeting when you need to do a presentation, and then some additional information is coming to the fore and you look like the complete idiot, but to make other people look better. And then the lack of empathy, as I mentioned, and the callousness, the cynicism. So that's one of the first things that we can start to see, I would say, is the aggression, the manipulation, the feeling of being baffled and second-guessing yourself. What have I done wrong? Because that's often what happens, is that you turn the emotion to yourself. You are in looking at yourself, what have I done wrong? And that's where the isolation is so detrimental, where if you can just do the reality check, you might find that, no, it wasn't you. It was actually the experience that you have that is very valid.
One figure which I find particularly interesting, albeit that it's not very high, is that nearly 4% of business leaders could be psychopaths. My question is, how do these individuals climb the corporate ladder so easily?
Sure, I think you mentioned some of it earlier in the interview, where these individuals can be masters of self-image. They are the rising stars. They will take the credit, but they will deflect blame, and they can have good characteristics which make people successful in business. They can be charm, they can be fearless, risk takers, strategists. They have courage, but even audacity, to push through massive change and transition despite the risks. And they have compelling visions and the ability to communicate this. So they have the charisma, inspire and attract followers initially, and that's how they rise.
And that can also be very attractive to a board of directors that is chasing results and profit. Is this also an issue about broader leadership culture, do you think?
I definitely think so. But once again, when we talk about narcissism, people might have narcissistic traits, but they might not have a narcissistic personality disorder. So narcissistic traits is almost where there might be some negative aspects, but mostly it's what we just discussed, this rising star that might be attractive to the board. It's when the negatives, the dark side, also come to play, when it can be really detrimental. But yes, we need to make decisions at board level, maybe sometimes bearing in mind other things that might be important. You need 360 feedback. You need maybe to look at the emotional and social intelligence of people. You need to really make sure about the track record. And one thing that we should guard off is concentrating power in one individual.
Of course, we've got to give a caveat here that not all ambition or rising stars within leaders are necessarily a sign of narcissism. The rising stars can also be very positive in their approach.
Absolutely. I think we must, and that's maybe the very first thing that I warned against, about using the label too easily. And I see it in popular media and social media. Every second person now, if they do something you don't like, oh no, they're narcissist or a psychopath. And that's not what we're talking about here. And as I said, if you have someone with narcissistic traits, with the positive aspects of it, that would be a good leader if they are prepared to reflect, if there is bigger policies in an organization to keep people accountable for their deeds and their actions, if there's transparency, you know, so there can be safeguards that really can leverage the positive characteristics and traits of the person.
And Professor, your research also points out that a third of South African employees leave due to toxic leadership. As I mentioned earlier, it has an impact on productivity, cost and morale. That seems to be an inordinately high figure, given that so many people simply don't have anywhere else to go.
Absolutely. I think employees is also a little bit, how can I say, at fault. I don't want to put the blame there, but we often do not reach out to professional support, which might have made or empower us to deal with the situation and not leave. But usually people reach out for professional support too late, and that is then followed by resignation, and then you sit with the consequences of not finding other employment. So I would really encourage people, if you do notice some of this behaviors around you, whether it's a peer, whether it is your boss, or even when it's a subordinate, because we can have upward bullying as well, reach out for professional assistance and HR support even earlier, because there's rules and regulations and laws in South Africa that do protect you.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Renata Skuman, Head of Healthcare Leadership at the Stellenbosch Business School. I appreciate your time. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.